NBC Radio Network celebrates its first Fabulous 50.
I will see you.
Hi, ho, everybody.
Good evening, Mr. First Master.
Good evening, Mr. and Mr. North American. All the ships at sea, let's go to press.
The only thing we have to fear.
Ladies and gentlemen, easy aces.
Mr. Allen!
Seek fire!
We are resolved to destroy Hitler.
Henry Aldrich!
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman.
You were expecting maybe Emperor Shapiro Hito?
Everybody awake! Let the word go forth.
Ignition. Liftoff.
I have a dream.
Hello, Linden.
How mortifying.
Flow like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
Let me make one point clear.
Robert Zemeckis!
NBC Radio, America's first network, presents highlights from its first 50 years. 5 one-hour shows with hosts John Chancellor, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Arlene Francis, and Ben Grauer. With special material by Gene Shalit. Brought to you in part by the premium wines of Ernest and Julio Gallo. By Delta, the airline run by professionals. Delta is ready when you are. By Wrigley Freedent Gum. And by Amana and your Amana retailers. And now, here's John Chancellor.
We've arrived at the final 10 years of the 50 we're covering in our anniversary programs, 1966 to 1976. What a decade it's been, taking our country through its most dangerous national crisis since the Civil War. There were bright moments, of course. People always managed to find something to laugh about. But the atmosphere then was one of continuously increasing tension, especially over Vietnam. In 1966, President Johnson took this position.
There will be some nervous Nellies, and some who will become frustrated and bothered and break ranks under the strain. And some will turn on their leaders and on their country and on our own fighting men. But I have not the slightest doubt that the courage and the dedication and the good sense of the wise American people will ultimately prevail.
Among those opposing President Johnson's views was the man who had helped a generation of parents raise some of the children who were now old enough to be sent to war, Dr. Benjamin Spock.
We will not acquiesce. We cannot. Our nation can and must stop this irrevocable rush to world war, this policy of American murder and devastation, in the name of national honor and pride, now.
Demonstrations against the war were countered by parades and rallies supporting our GIs in Vietnam, and the bitterness grew.
We are saved!
No, you're assuming here, you know, more than the president.
No, we're assuming.
Yes, you
that
are.
The president is.
You are not. You're not giving him a break. You're not even to give him a fair chance.
Sir,
and that's not being a real American, really.
We are saved!
As I'm concerned, this country is in a state of war right now, and all these people protesting what the government does are traitors.
They should check their
treason. It's treason.
I know from the flag, Paul.
When do we want it?
No!
What do we want?
But despite the protests, the war went on. Life went on. In 1967, we worked and played, cheered our favorite teams, the Cardinals won the World Series, went to the movies, Bonnie and Clyde was a big favorite, marveled at the first heart transplant, and laughed with Phyllis Diller on monitor.
Do you realize that the hardest thing I do all day long is taking that first look in the mirror in the morning? Because overnight, I forget. And then sometimes by the time I fall into bed at night, I'm quite beautiful. I drink a little. But I have decided the only way to get out of bed every morning with a big smile on your face is to go to bed with a hanger in your mouth.
And in Monitor's glass-fronted studio, Johnny Carson was interviewed by host Ed McMahon.
You've done so many different things. What are your plans after the Tonight Show?
I'm going to go to a movie. And you want to have some dinner?
No. I mean after you finish up your current contract, some 3 years from now.
I wanted to go into the aluminum siding business. Very bad a couple of weeks ago.
But so I thought you've always said to me there was no business like show business.
Oh, there is.
Yeah.
Roofing business, hardware business is very, very similar. But I like the aluminum siding.
Ladies and gentlemen, our guest on Monitor.
Is that it?
Well, unless you have anything else you want to say.
Oh, my golly, I came up here, gave up a whole afternoon to come up here.
We have to go right on. We've got good fishing advice waiting in the wings.
Oh, is that what follows us?
Yes.
Good fishing advice.
And we plunge into some other important things.
Well, this is it, okay.
It's awfully nice of you to come down and spend a few minutes with us here on Monitor.
Anytime.
That was Johnny Carson, ladies and gentlemen.
It'll be the last time. Don't expect to see me here again.
You see him at night a lot.
Brought
in
here
tonight
for 5 minutes and taken right out. Want to talk to me. In depth, you said. In depth. Questions like, how are you? I'm fine. What is that?
Thank you, Johnny.
We really needed the laughs in those days. The six-day Arab-Israeli war had shaken the world, and the protests over Vietnam were becoming more heated than ever. In February of 1968, Senator Robert Kennedy, once dubbed a hawk, now said,
a total military victory is probably beyond our grasp. And the effort to win such a victory will only result in the further slaughter of thousands of innocent and helpless people, a slaughter which will forever rest on all of our consciences.
It was a familiar chant in those days. Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? Then, on March 31st, President Johnson startled the nation with this announcement.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
And with those words began one of the most traumatic election years in our history.
John Chancellor will return with more of the first Fabulous 50 shortly. The first Fabulous 50 continues. Once again, John Chancellor.
As we moved into the late 60s, the country was divided, not only over Vietnam, but by something called the Generation Gap. Many of our young people were striking out in altogether new directions, sometimes with tragic results.
I smoke marijuana. I use LSD. I've taken methadrine and opium.
The drug subculture persisted, and other cultures developed as well. As always, cultural changes seem to be reflected in the popular music of the times. And we've asked Gene Shalit for some words to go with the music.
John, it wasn't just the words in this particular song that mattered to some members of the younger generation. The initials even held a message for them. Lucy, Sky, Diamonds, LSD. But not all of the new music was about dropping out and copping out.
This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
The Broadway musical Hair evolved out of protests by young people against poverty and bigotry and the Vietnam War.
These families, ask them how they feel about their son going to war, fighting, when he can't even get a decent job in America. My father fought in World War II. You know what? He's still a nigger. You know that? He's a veteran, but he's still a nigger.
And in their age of Aquarius, many in the younger generation saw an age of freer sexual attitudes. They took their clothes off, and a lot of their parents followed suit, or took off suit. Remember beautiful Anne Bancroft in The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman?
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. She loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
That movie mirrored the disillusion many young people felt with an older generation that seemed mainly interested in plastics. Get into plastics, young man. That was what The Graduate was told. But some young people began to get into something else. They got into religion. Not in the traditional forms, and definitely not with traditional music.
Jesus Christ, who are you, what have you done?
For some, religion was a challenge, and they challenged right back.
Who are you? Have you sacrificed? Peace, mind. Human sacrifice. Human sacrifice.
For others, religion was a refuge.
My sweet Lord.
There were those who were called Jesus freaks because they found salvation in him.
We were searching through dope. You know, I was shooting a lot of heroin, and we were confused. Then I finally asked Jesus into my heart, and I had no withdrawal from the heroin that I was shooting. And this miracle that was wrought in my body was too much.
That's just a small sample, John, of the kinds of music that accompanied the social changes in the past 10 years. And even many people who didn't approve of the changes enjoyed the music anyhow.
That's right, Gene. Gene Shalit, of course. Well, we've already described this decade as being one of the most crisis-ridden in our history. And the struggle by black Americans for their rights was a major part of it. In a quiet moment, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. spoke with NBC's Frank McGee.
I know that your home has been dynamited and that you have had threats made against your life on many occasions. I would like to know what your feelings on it are.
And if physical death is the price that some must pay, if it's the price that I must pay to free my children and the children of my brothers and sisters and my white brothers from a permanent psychological death, then nothing can be more redemptive. If a man has not discovered something so dear and so precious that he will die for it, then he doesn't have much to live for.
Then, on April 4th, 1968...
This is an NBC News Hotline special report. Here is Don Hickman in Memphis.
Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was shot outside a Memphis motel this afternoon. His condition is not known at this time.
With the killing of Dr. King, riots broke out in a number of big cities. Federal troops had to be used in Washington to restore order. And finally, a tense and unhappy country turned its attention to the presidential race. In Los Angeles, on the 5th of June, Robert Kennedy had been celebrating his victory in the California primary, and then... President Kennedy, then Dr. King, and now Robert Kennedy. It was almost beyond belief. But the presidential race had to be run, and after a riotous convention week in Chicago, Hubert Humphrey was chosen by the Democrats. His opponent, Richard Nixon.
John Chancellor returns with more of NBC's first 50 years shortly.
Now that...
NBC Radio's first Fabulous 50 continues. Once again, John Chancellor.
The traditional lack of reverence Americans show for politicians, even when they reach the top rung of the ladder, is one of the country's strengths. And so after Richard Milhouse Nixon was elected to succeed Lyndon Johnson, one of the most popular sounds on our radios was that of impressionist David Fry.
It's Dick and Pat.
It's Pick and Pat.
No, Dick and Pat. The president-elect and Mrs.-elect.
Welcome to the White House.
We got the election returns this morning. I got here as fast
as I could. All right, I'll give you the tour. Company coming up, Lady Bird. Beautify yourself.
The real President Nixon, once he took office, had some very serious problems to contend with, and although he had campaigned on a promise to get us out of Vietnam, he had some second thoughts.
What happens in Vietnam halfway around the world? And whether Americans meet their responsibility there may affect the future of not only Vietnam, not only the other nations in the Pacific, but the future of America itself.
And so, despite announcements of some troop withdrawals, the end was not in sight. And, as is the case in times of great stress, some people sought solace in religion. On NBC Radio, we continued our tradition of presenting regular weekly programs in cooperation with the major religious denominations. The National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations present the National Radio Pulpit in cooperation with the National Council of the Churches of Christ. And there was the weekly dramatic show produced with the help of the Jewish Theological Seminary, The Eternal Life. And of course there was the Catholic Hour, which is now called Guideline. Incidentally, for many years it's been an NBC tradition to broadcast a midnight mass on Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve of 1968 was very special. The Apollo 8 mission orbited the moon and sent this greeting from a quarter million miles away.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth.
Each of the three astronauts, Frank Borman, James Lovell Jr., and William Anders, read a passage from Genesis. And finally,
we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
Then, just a little over 6 months later, the country, the world, was thrilled by this event.
Contact right. Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent. Out of control, both auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
And the next day, July 21st, 1969, Neil Armstrong became the first human to set foot on the moon.
That's one small step for man.
A new frontier had been opened. It may be centuries, it may be millennia before we really explore it, but it was a start. Right now it's time for a stop, a pause to be more precise, in our celebration of NBC Radio's first Fabulous 50. And we celebrate it with the electronic sounder that's replaced our older NBC chimes.
The NBC Radio Network continues celebrating its first Fabulous 50. Brought to you in part by your neighborhood McDonald's restaurant. At McDonald's, we do it all for you. By True Value Hardware Stores, not just a name, it's our way of doing business. And by Alice Chalmers, the world needs more of what Alice Chalmers makes. And here, once again, is John Chancellor.
Before we move on through our most recent years, we'd like you to listen carefully to this report from NBC correspondent Howard Tuckner in Saigon, Vietnam, in 1968, outside the U.S. Embassy, which had been occupied by the Viet Cong.
Now the MCs are storming the U.S. Embassy. They've just broken the gate open. Some more shots are coming. We see a firing bazooka-type weapon. Sounds like that from here. We're right on our stomachs in the gutter outside the U.S. Embassy in Saigon.
Like so many NBC newsmen before and since, Tuckner was risking his life to report the story. As a matter of fact, he was wounded covering another action just a few days later. And there were friends. Welt Hangen, who was captured in Cambodia and never heard from again. To this day, we don't know whether he's dead or alive. And George Clay in the Congo, killed in the middle of reporting the war there. Their dedication deserves, at the very least, this small mention. Here at home, on April 30th, 1970, the country discovered it had a larger war on its hands in Southeast Asia than it had thought. President Nixon spoke.
Tonight, American and South Vietnamese units will attack the headquarters for the entire communist military operation in South Vietnam. This key control center has been occupied by the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong for 5 years in blatant violation of Cambodia's neutrality.
This news produced a new outburst in anti-war protest meetings. At Kent State University in Ohio, 4 students were killed by National Guardsmen, whose commander explained the shootings as retaliation for sniper fire.
The troopers apparently felt that their own life was in danger, and under these conditions, they are permitted to shoot.
One graduate student, a research assistant, didn't see it that way at all.
When the firing started, there was no sniper fire. It was an immediate burst, and it continued. By this time, it was like mass hysteria. Students were crying. They were screaming for ambulances. I heard some girl screaming, "They didn't have blanks. They didn't have blanks." No, they didn't.
The Kent State tragedy heightened what had already been labeled the campus crisis, as students across the country not only protested the war, but demanded liberation from what they claimed were oppressive, old-fashioned educational policies. As a matter of fact, this was the decade of liberation movements. And once again, we're calling on Gene Shalit, a bit of a rebel himself, for some of his expertise. Gene?
Rebel? Revolting, maybe. John, here at NBC, we were promoting liberation a long time ago. Listen to the title of this program, broadcast back in 1937.
But women have brains.
That's right. In those days, we actually had to try to persuade listeners to accept a basic fact of life. But in the past 10 years, women have made that kind of a program unnecessary. I am Betty sang it all in that song, and women's liberation leaders, women like Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem and Karen DeCroix, have gotten the message across in their own ways, through books, protest marches, pressures on Congress. Women have made gains, but not as fast or as far-reaching as they'd like. Here is Liz Carpenter, co-leader of the drive to get the Equal Rights Amendment ratified, at a rally earlier this year.
I want to be, and I want other American women to be, in the Constitution of our country. We are not now. Our mothers and our grandmothers were never fully counted into the life of this country. It would have been a better place if they had been.
Carpenter hammered home her point, and a lot of people will agree with her. In another kind of liberation movement, a seemingly lighthearted song reveals a difficult truth.
Mom and Pop, how do I tell you? I never thought I'd ever find my nerve. Mom and Pop, don't wanna hurt you. Pain is something you don't deserve. How many times did I lie? How many nights did I cry? There's no other way, I'll just have to come right out in here.
As in other liberation movements, those who are homosexual are asking only that they be allowed the rights all citizens are entitled to, and that they not be discriminated against. And they feel that the public's image of them is all wrong.
There are a number of, you know, effeminate homosexuals around. Effeminacy sometimes is a defense. Something like less than 1% of all homosexuals are visible to the outsider. You know, a wrestler, racing car drivers are very often gay, and that may be a gear.
And then there's another group that's looking for public support, and they've used a verbal spin-off of the gay power movement to attract attention to themselves. They've taken gay power and turned it into gray power.
Old folks don't go out, strangers make them ill at ease. Old folks stay at home, nursing their infirmities.
Our senior citizens do not intend to be pushed around either. They've been organizing. And since each of us is headed in their direction, it wouldn't surprise me if they pick up a lot of support. John?
Thank you, Gene. There was another kind of liberation movement, if we can call it that, which had deadly results, unfortunately. We'll get to that shortly.
John Chancellor will be back with more from NBC's first 50 years right after this. NBC Radio continues the celebration of its first 50 years. Here once again, John Chancellor.
As we heard a minute or so ago, demands for an individual's rights became widespread. Not even our prisons were immune from this. Among them was Attica in upstate New York, where, in 1971, prisoners seized guards as hostages. One of the convict leaders rallied his men.
I appeal, beseech you all to stand with us. Walk with us. Die with us if necessary.
I hear you.
You and all the people. Power to you and all the people.
According to the convicts, conditions in the prison had been unbearable and the guards brutal. But outside the prison walls, wives and relatives of the hostages felt differently.
I like to show them a little brutality. Is this being brutal to us or not? Brutal, my husband, brutal?
Those troopers should have gone in for him. There's no sense in going on with it forever. I don't want to see anybody die either, but it's got to end somewhere.
It did. State troopers stormed the prison. 32 prisoners and 10 guards were killed. Hostages also had become the pawns in another kind of violence, airplane hijackings. One act of violence seemed to follow another almost daily. A massacre of 26 passengers at Tel Aviv Airport in 1972. Governor George Wallace gunned down during the presidential primary campaign that year. And then, one night in September, on NBC Radio, Bud Greenspan reported from Munich.
A day which began in tragedy has ended in even greater tragedy. After an evening of conflicting reports which began with news that the Israeli hostages were safe, it is now certain that 7 and perhaps all 9 are dead.
The Olympic massacre. We seemed then to be living in a bloody nightmare. Some people began to look back wistfully to the good old days when life was gentler. Nostalgia took over, and I'm going to ask Gene Shalit to take over again for a little while. One more time, Gene.
John, in the now nostalgic words of Rudy Valley, my time is your time. Tiny Tim as a Pied Piper, we tiptoed back to the pleasant past, mainly back to its music. The Broadway musical No, No, Nanette was revived and it was a smash. And if there had ever been a Yes, Yes, Yvette, that probably would have been revived too. But there's no need to go to Broadway for nostalgia in music. We've got plenty of it right here at NBC. Let's start with a classic performance from the old Major Bowes Amateur Hour.
When it's twilight on the trail, and I jog along, the world is like a dream, and the ripple of the stream is my song.
Fred, I'm afraid you're not quite ready yet either. Pretty young.
That was 40 years ago. But I doubt if he ever got ready. Then there was the night Fibber McGee led the Wistful Vista Businessmen's Band.
On the downbeat, the pizzicato polka. If anything happens, we'll go into Tipperary. 1, 2, spiel!
It could be that Fibber McGee inspired another NBC musical talent. No, not Toscanini, but a fella named Jones, who spiked a beautiful romantic ballad, Cocktails for Two,
for the very first time on a Bing Crosby show in 1944.
In some secluded rendezvous.
That overlooks the avenue. With someone sharing a delight. Look at that, look at this, and that. Cocktail for two. My head may go reeling, but my heart will be overbeating with intoxicating kisses for the principal ingredients. In the afternoon at five, we'll be so glad we're both alive. Then maybe fortune will complete her plan that all began with cocktails for two.
I guess we could say they're not writing songs like that today, but then they don't have to, John. Not as long as there's an NBC musical memory bank to draw from.
That's true, Gene Shalit. Thank you. Getting back to the 70s, we find another somewhat unusual performance. A Chinese orchestra in Peking, China, playing Home on the Range. The occasion was President Nixon's historic visit to China. I was in the Great Hall of the People when he made this toast.
To Chairman Mao, to Prime Minister Cho, and to the friendship of the Chinese and American people, which can lead to friendship and peace for all people in the world.
Mr. Nixon didn't know it at the time, of course, but aside from his re-election in 1972, this was to be perhaps the final triumph of his political career.
John Chancellor will return with more of the First Fabulous 50 shortly. NBC Radio's First Fabulous 50 continues. Once again, John Chancellor.
One of the prize-winning radio documentaries in the NBC News Second Sunday series was titled High Crimes and Misdemeanors and began with this dramatization.
Question!
Question!
To the cries of question, question, the presiding officer put before the assembly the motion. Shall the executive be removable on impeachments? The roll was called. Massachusetts.
No!
The framers of our Constitution were deciding on the safeguard without which our democratic form of government might never have survived. And so, in 1787, the stage was set for an incredible chain of events that began in 1972. It was barely noticed at the beginning, just a small item in an hourly newscast on June 18th.
Five men, one a former CIA agent, are being held in Washington after being caught in the act of apparently trying to bug the offices of the Democratic National Committee. Three of the men are native-born Cubans. There is no indication of why the men sought to...
The burglars were convicted. White House aides implicated. And finally, on the 25th of June, 1973, before a Senate investigating committee headed by Senator Sam Ervin, John Dean began to testify.
The Watergate matter was an inevitable outgrowth of a climate of excessive concern over the political impact of demonstrators, excessive concern over leaks, an insatiable appetite for political intelligence, all coupled with a do-it-yourself White House staff, regardless of the law.
Another aide, Alexander Butterfield, revealed that the president had taped all his conversations in the Oval Office and in the White House, and efforts were made to obtain them. The president tried to carry on with the country's affairs. In August, he appointed Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State.
The foreign policy of the United States is not a partisan matter, but it concerns the whole nation, that the future of our country transcends any particular administration.
In October, Vice President Spiro Agnew, noted for such alliterative allusions to the news media as nattering nabobs of negativism, resigned. After employing two non-alliterative words, no contest, in answer to a charge of income tax evasion, he was replaced by Congressman Gerald Ford. On November the 11th, at an Associated Press convention, President Nixon commented on various charges then being made against him.
I welcome this kind of examination because people have got to know
whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
In the meantime, attempts to get the presidential tapes continued. We'd had the generation gap and the credibility gap, and now we had the 18-and-a-half-minute tape gap. Month by month, the evidence against the president accumulated, and finally, a House subcommittee on impeachment headed by Congressman Peter Rodino voted on July 27, 1974.
Clerk will report. 27 members have voted aye. 11 members have voted no.
And pursuant to the resolution, Article 1, that resolution is adopted and will be reported to the House.
On August the 8th, President Nixon, rather than face impeachment, bowed to the inevitable.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
There was one final act before the curtain fell. On the 8th of September, President Ford took this action.
I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, by these presents do grant a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
The country was stunned, but the deed was done. And with that, Richard Nixon's political life came to an end.
John Chancellor will be back with more from NBC's first 50 years right after this. The first Fabulous 50 continues. Here's John Chancellor.
As we approached the close of NBC Radio's first 50 years, we found a world eager for news. We've gone all out to provide it. Kurt Gowdy was on hand when Henry Aaron broke Babe Ruth's all-time home run record.
Aaron, in his earlier days, used to hit more to right, right center than the left. That's a long drive. Balls it deep, deep. It is gone. He did it.
Jim Laurie, NBC News in Saigon, was the first to broadcast the surrender that ended the 30 years of war in Vietnam.
General Minh called on all South Vietnamese troops to lay down their arms and remain in place. He announced a unilateral ceasefire and an unconditional surrender.
When the controversial supersonic plane, the Concorde, made its first commercial flight to this country, NBC newsman Steve Porter was there in the cockpit talking to the pilot.
Captain, right about now we are going twice the speed of sound.
We just reached twice the speed of sound at this time.
What altitude are we at right now?
We're just reaching flight level of 50,000 feet.
What is your...
And when the U.S. space program reached a new milestone this year, Dan Blackburn at the Jet Propulsion Laboratories gave us the news.
There is a delay between the landing and confirmation because of the vast gulf of miles lying between Mars and Earth, and so it takes 19 minutes to find out whether or not, indeed, the lander is on the surface of the red planet. Those 19 minutes have just about... There, you can probably hear the cheers. Touchdown is confirmed. The Viking has landed on Mars.
And one really big event of 1976 began with this proclamation by the president.
I hereby proclaim that the 200th anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence be observed by the simultaneous ringing of bells throughout the United States at the hour of 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time on the afternoon of 4th of July.
And on that weekend of the 4th, from coast to coast, from big cities and towns and villages, Americans of every size, shape, age, and color poured into the streets, paraded, sang, danced, participated in pageants, and showed an affection for each other that had been all too rare. For those few golden hours, we had a glimpse of what the future could be. Well, we've elected the man who will lead us for the next 4 years, and he has told us...
I'm not afraid to take on the responsibilities of President of the United States because my strength and my courage and my advice and my counsel and my criticism comes from you. And if I can tap the greatness that's in you and in the American people, we can make our nation's government great and a source of pride once again.
As we move on through the years ahead on NBC Radio, we'll continue to bring you the rich variety of sounds that reflect our times. We face problems, of course, the maintenance of peace, the pitfalls of inflation and unemployment, the continuing struggle for civil rights, and the conservation of our natural resources. But there's a bright side to life as well, and it could be that if we all work hard enough at it, we may be able to say, as one newscaster used to say many years ago, there's good news tonight. This is John Chancellor, NBC News.
You have been listening to the First Fabulous 50, produced by Elliot Drake and Charles Garment. Creative assistance by Warren Hogan. Written by Charles Garment. Directed by Elliot Drake. NBC.